Let's have the joint committees come to order. It's about 1:33 on the afternoon of Wednesday, February the 8th, 2012. It's a joint hearing today. There's no official business being transacted, so there's no need for a quorum, but we do have present with us Senator Fred Dyson, Senator Wilikowski, myself, Senator French, Senator Davis, Senator McGuire, and as other people join us, we'll, of course, stop and take notice of them. But we have a very important presentation. We have members and representatives from the Children's Justice Act Task Force. And we're looking forward to this presentation. We joined the two committees together because it seemed more efficient to have you make one presentation to a bunch of us instead of a bunch of presentations to a group of us spread out. And so why don't you just go ahead and introduce yourselves for the record and tell us what you're going to tell us, and then get started.
Okay. My name is Jan Rutherdale, and you, I've probably presented before here as an assistant attorney general. But today I'm before you as chair of the Children's Justice Act Force.
And welcome, Jana. Let's just stop for a second and welcome Senator Egan and Senator Meyer to the committee. Thank you.
Do you want them to introduce themselves?
Sure, why don't we go ahead and do that, and then we'll jump in.
I'm Kathy Baldwin-Johnston. I'm a family physician from Wasilla, and I'm the medical director for the Children's Place, which is the Child Advocacy Center in Wasilla, and Alaska Cares, which is the Child Advocacy Center in Anchorage.
Welcome. And are you Dr. Johnson?
Yes, I am.
You'd be Dr. Johnson. Okay, very good.
Just widely known hero.
Very much so. In fact, we rode together on the airplane. We rode down together on the airplane, and while I was sort of leafing through a magazine, she was very, very hard at work on her presentation. So, focused individual. It was impressive.
And I am Tom Janidlow. I'm attorney in private practice in Anchorage, previously with the AG's office, and am co-chair of the this task force.
Fantastic. Welcome to the three of you, and I'll turn it over to the floor. It's yours to use your time as you see fit.
Okay. And we have a PowerPoint. Is that something that
I think they can?
Oh, you can
raise
okay, got it.
You sure can.
All right.
And
all
while
right.
You're just getting set up, we'll welcome Senator Coghill to the committee as well.
Okay. Great. First, I want to thank you so much for allowing us to present to you jointly today. And I wanted to give a little overview of our presentation. I'll be doing the background on the CJA, who we are, what we do. Dr. Baldwin-Johnson will be talking about some trends and costs of child maltreatment in Alaska. And in both Mr. Janidlow and Dr. Baldwin-Johnson will be talking about the proposed legislative changes that we have for you. Regarding the background, we've been in operation for 10 years now. It's a federal program, and it's in all 50 states. It's a the federal government requires in setting this up that there's discipline. There's a certain number of disciplines represented that deal with maltreatment field. We have you can have up to 21 members. We have 19 currently, and I'm not going to. I would ask that the members of the task force stand up.
That's helpful. Thank you.
I won't introduce them by name, but you do have in your materials the content, more information.
Nice
about
way to
them.
Handle it. Thank you.
Yes, and this is a federally funded. It's federally funded. We're not asking you for money, but we wanted to just note that it's based on population, and since we're a small state, it's a small pool of money that we work with. And the point of that is we try to use our limited dollars wisely and focus on the areas that we think are most in need at that moment. We rely on the volunteer of our group members, and also rely on collaboration with other groups that are working on similar issues. I'm not going to read you our mission statement, but as you can see, it's a pretty wide mandate. We could take it in numerous ways, but what we do is we choose our projects based on the importance in issues of that, you know, who's not covering what. Again, we work with collaboration of other people. This year, we're particularly focused on the criminal laws, and that will be, as I said, part of our presentation. But I wanted to talk a little bit about some of our projects. We have can be loosely categorized into three project areas: The third one, as I said, we're going to be make one of our tasks is to make recommendations for law changes. I won't mention that further because that's the basis further on in our presentation. With respect to data, we quickly realized that without good data, you don't know what the problems are, and it's difficult to come up with good data. I'm sure you all are aware of that, especially because the systems that operate the agencies, they have different definitions, and it's very hard to get the numbers to mesh. And we are very grateful for our collaboration with the Department of Health and Social Services Maternal Child Health and Epidemiology Unit. They have this scan program that has been working to try to get the data to match up better, and they've been helping us to provide that data, and we're starting to see some good results on that.
Question on that.
Yes, you can interrupt us.
I'm sure that you have consulted with Dr. Rosé at the Justice Center, mm-hmm. and I know he doesn't gather data, but he's a great analyst. And I just don't know to what degree his institution's been able to help yours.
Yes, we have worked with him in the past. We've had him come speak to us, present some of his presentations. And I think we would probably have relied on him more if we hadn't the members of the SCAN unit has been a member of our task force, and so we've really worked most closely with them. But for example, we know we were told yesterday by Katie Tipas that there some master's candidates are looking for projects, so we will be contacting them. They're a very good resource.
Sounds good. And let's recognize that Senator Ellis has joined us. Please continue.
Sure. Our task to improve the system response is really three areas, and I wanted to talk each area in turn. The first is within that category of improving the system response is to support the development of CACs, child advocacy centers, and multidisciplinary teams. CACs have been in existence since 1996. They started with one CAC, and now they're up to 10 with two satellite centers. And they were federally funded up until 2 years ago, and the legislature has picked up the loss of federal funding. It's not a budget that's been increasing, but they've been able to impressively continue to open centers with that budget. So we've worked with them. We've also, in related to the CACs and MDTs, is we've put out two publications. One is in 2010 we developed the guidelines for the multidisciplinary response, which helps explain all the roles involved in the initial response to investigations. So the child comes to the child advocacy center, and it just sets out the best the guidelines for investigations. And then along the same line, we've helped support the standardized medical documentation forms that are used in the physical exams at the CACs. And then the second sort of area is to support the innovative programs. There's two programs I'd like to talk about right now that we've supported. One is the Pathway to Hope, which is an Alaska it was a program that was developed in Alaska by Alaska Natives, as it says, to work together to heal the intergenerational trauma of sexual abuse. It's a training curriculum, and it's been presented 250 times in Alaska, and it is also being developed presented nationally and internationally. Then the other programs specifically deal with the sexual exploitation of children, and particularly the internet issues of pornography or just exposure to the predators can use the internet as ways to get to children. And so we've worked with the Internet Crimes Against Children unit of the law enforcement. We've helped work with the NetSmarts. It's another program law enforcement developed. And also we've provided staff to help in-school education programs to get to the children and the parents, perhaps more importantly, the parents, to let them know that this is happening and could potentially, their child could be a big victim of it. So it's not, those aren't programs that we've support, we've developed ourselves, but we do support through funding. For example, Pathway to Hope, we provide the materials the money to publish the training curriculum. The third area is to improve the system response is education and training. We've developed the mandatory reporter training CD, and we continue to distribute that. We've brought copies of it. We'll be leaving copies for you, each member of the committee, and it's also on our website. We also encourage professional development through offering scholarships for trainings and also being a sponsor of the Child Maltreatment Conference that's the Alaska Children's Alliance presents, bringing up experts from outside to Alaska, and so we help sponsor that and provide scholarships for those trainings as well. And just for a plug, this year's conference is the week of I think October 22nd of this year. And then finally, as an education piece, we have done yearly legislative presentations, and for probably 6 years or so, I don't know exactly, we've presented before the Children's Caucus, and the types of things we've presented are presentations on meth labs, presentations on the internet crimes issues, data that we've been gathering, the Pathway to Hope program that I just mentioned, and the other internet crimes against safety programs. The last 2 years we've presented actually to the legislature. I mean, this will be our third year presenting to legislative committees. And in the last couple years, parts of our presentation has been to talk about the gaps that we see as some gaps in our criminal laws that we just we feel that children are not getting the protection they need, or maybe conversely that the offenders are not getting the crimes that that perhaps we feel they deserve. And this past year we've actually went a step further to actually develop the legislation, and that's before you today, and that's what we'll be talking about now. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Dr. Baldwin Johnson talking about the child maltreatment in Alaska.
Great. We're looking forward to that. We'll just stop for a second, though, and welcome Senator Pascrane to the committee.
Thank you.
All right.
Dr. Johnson, Baldwin Johnson, please go ahead.
Thank you, and thank you again for allowing us to speak before you at this joint session. So I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the data about child maltreatment in Alaska and try to put some numbers on that so that you understand exactly what that economic burden is when children are treated poorly. I'm going to talk a little bit first about maltreatment-related deaths. This data is from 2008, which is the most recent year that we have available right now. About one out of every five Alaska children who dies as a result of some kind of maltreatment. If we look at Alaska Native children, they're disproportionately represented in this population as well, and that one out of four Alaska children die as a result of maltreatment. And nearly three out of four of those deaths are actually to infants. So infants and young children are certainly the most vulnerable to dying from maltreatment-related causes.
Just while we're diving into the data, which I'm sure we're all going to find very interesting, and it's always very disturbing, maybe you can just give us a little background on what the source of the data is. Are they reports of harm to OCS? Are they police reports, troopers? Where do you get your numbers?
These numbers came out of the SCAN, the Surveillance of Child Abuse and Neglect Program, that's part of DHSS Maternal Child Health Epidemiology Unit. And so these are actually a compilation of data from multiple sources. The Jared Parrish, who was the head of that program, was actually able to arrange with all of these different divisions and departments to be able to use their data and compile a more complete picture. So it does include child protection reports, it includes police reports, it includes data from the court system. So it's it includes hospital discharge data. So it is able to combine all of those different data sources so that we have a better picture of what's going on, because each one of those data sources in and of itself misses other pieces.
Infant mortality.
Thank you. The maternal infant mortality review team for the state, some of this information comes out of that as well. Sure. They review all of the infant and child deaths that occur in Alaska. If we look at all types of maltreatment, and this is looking at living children, maltreatment actually includes abuse and neglect. So it includes physical abuse and sexual abuse as well as neglect. In 2008, about 12,400 Alaskan children were likely victims of one incident of maltreatment. So this is not just looking at reports. This is a smaller number than the reports that were made. This is children for whom there was a report made and or there was a police report or a medical diagnosis, something else that supported this child likely being a victim of maltreatment. Of those, about a quarter, just under a quarter, had that incident confirmed, and that was confirmed by a successful prosecution or by a substantiation by the Office of Children's Services. I think that it's important that we all understand, and I'm sure you do, that those that are substantiated or where there's a conviction is really represents the tip of the iceberg, that, you know, it's that the bar is set high for many good reasons to be able to substantiate or convict someone of harming a child. So just because it's not substantiated or convicted doesn't mean that it didn't happen to this child. And in fact, there's quite a bit of good research out there that shows that outcomes for children whose abuse is not substantiated are very similar for those children for whom their abuse is substantiated. This translates to about 34 children a day that are likely maltreated in our state, which is about 3,000 children during this 90-day legislative session. If we look at some of the particular types of maltreatment, neglect is certainly the most common, and that's true in Alaska as well as in the rest of the country. So just under 9,000 children that were likely victims of at least one incident of neglect. And of those, again, about a quarter were they confirmed, usually by OCS substantiation, which translates, again, to about 25 children a day or over 2,000 children during the 90-day legislative session. If we look in particular at physical abuse, about 2,700 children were likely victims of physical abuse. Of those, about 22% had the incident confirmed, which translates to about 7 children a day here in Alaska. And then if we look in particular at sexual abuse, about 1,900 children are likely victims each year of one incident, at least, of sexual abuse. And of those, about 16% had at least that one of those incidents confirmed. And the reason that the substantiation or conviction rate is so much lower in sexual abuse is that that's the hardest one. I mean, these are often very young children. They typically have normal exams. There's often no corroborating evidence. So these are the cases that are the very hardest to prove. So it doesn't mean that only 16% of these children were truly sexually abused. It's just that it was not possible to take this to be a successful conviction.
And let me just ask about that. This is always an area of great concern, statewide about what's happening to our children. Do these estimates include, for example, are they all touching cases or penetration cases, or does it also include, for example, exposure to pornography over the internet and other sort of less direct but still very harmful sort of activities?
These cases are usually the exposure to pornography ends up falling into a different category. So these usually are cases where there's actual contact between the child and victim.
Okay. It's a personal crime.
Yes.
Thank you for the clarification.
That translates to 5 Alaskan children a day who are likely victims of sexual abuse in our state. So what does this cost? And it does cost us. It costs us in medical care of these children. It costs us in mental health care of these children. And it doesn't just cost us for medical and mental health care for the children, but it also costs us for the adults that they become. And I'll talk about this in just a second. It costs us in our child protection system. It costs us in our juvenile justice criminal system. It costs us in our adult criminal justice system. It affects future earnings. There's, again, good research that shows that children who are abused grow up to be adults who don't earn as much, that they are not, they miss more work. They don't earn as high a living as adults who do not have a history of abuse. And it affects quality of life, which is probably the hardest thing to try to put a dollar figure on. In terms of healthcare costs, I don't know how many of you are familiar with this, but there was a landmark study that was done through the Centers for Disease Control. It's called the Adverse Childhood Experiences Studies. And they took people that were enrolled in this health maintenance organization, Kaiser Permanente in California. So this means they had jobs, and they were mostly middle-aged adults. And they looked at their current health, and they asked them questions about that, what their childhood was like. And they found this astonishing link between bad things happening to children and all of the most common causes of adult disease and death in our country today. So children who are abused are more likely to get cancer. They're more likely to get heart disease. They're more likely to get lung disease. They're more likely to get diabetes. They're more likely to get osteoporosis-related fractures. So there are these very clear dose-related links. And the reason that the first article that came out was called Turning Gold into Lead is that you take something that happens to a child and it affects them for the rest of their life. Certainly, we are paying rising health care costs in our country, and it's something that our country is struggling with. And it's not just our country. I mean, I'm sure the state of Alaska has a very similar graph that shows these rising health care costs. And we know that child maltreatment certainly is a contributor to some of those. And it's really been a challenge, I think, for researchers to try to put any sort of a dollar figure on this. So I was actually really excited, just in time for our presentation. There was actually an article that was e-published. It's not quite out in print yet, but it will be here within the next few weeks. And it was called The Economic Burden of Child Maltreatment in the United States. And what they did was to look at fatal and non-fatal child abuse and use very conservative numbers and see what does that cost over the lifetime or potential lifetime of that child. And so these are national numbers. They estimated the average medical cost for a child who dies as a result of child maltreatment is about $14,000. And they estimated over $1.2 million for productivity losses for this child. So this was almost $1.3 million in cost per average case of fatal child maltreatment. If you look at just infants in Alaska, about 10 infants every year in Alaska die as a result of maltreatment. So this is only looking at infants. We'd be looking at close to $13 million lost every year as a result of just the infants that die. If we include older children that die, that number would probably be about twice that amount. if we look at the average lifetime cost per case of non-fatal child maltreatment, and you can see the breakdown in the numbers there, for each child, that lifetime cost for their short-term health care, their long-term health care, lost productivity, et cetera, comes to about $210,000 per child over the course of their lifetime. If we, again, look at our Alaska numbers, where we have somewhere between 3,000 children, if you just look at children for whose abuse is substantiated or where there's a conviction, up to that over 12,000 children where abuse is strongly suspected to have occurred, we start looking at somewhere between $625 million to $2.6 billion a year as a result of child maltreatment. That's the economic burden for Alaskans. So this starts adding up to a very real and very large amount of money.
Last year, we presented to the HS committee, and we were...
Maybe just for the Senate, as records keepers, just remind us of your name and title.
Yes, okay, my name is Tom Janitlo.
Thank you, Mr. Janitlo.
And also, as a caveat, I'm a private attorney in civil law, so if you have any specific questions about the criminal law, there are people back here who can answer that question.
Okay.
But I was asked to make your presentation, so here I am. over the past year, we did a pretty extensive review, not only of our statutes, but the statutes of the other states, and to see how we compared and where we stood. And in that review, we found out that there was a pretty good shortfall in our statutes. We became increasingly aware that these shortcomings had a direct impact not only on children, but also the shortfall is also on how the perpetrators were affected. Our laws now, we think, and with our proposals here, we think we have some improvements that would overcome these shortfalls and make these perpetrators fully accountable and also help protect our children. Sometimes the current laws allow a perpetrator of some pretty harmful, hurtful acts on a child to be let go with a slap on the wrist, and there'll be some examples of that in our presentation. Ironically, it's under our state, violations of fish and game law sometimes get you a stiffer penalty than some of the crimes that we'll be seeing here. What we propose to do is to raise the bar of accountability to those who do perpetrate these crimes, and also to give a greater level of protection to our children. And we do this through our proposal of this proposed change. The change we want to have in our criminal statutes, we have actually four recommendations. One is to modify the assault statutes to create a broader criminal liability for assaults on children. The problem is with the definition I think we have of what's required for a felony prosecution. You need a serious physical injury. And the way our statute is defined now, what constitutes a serious physical injury sometimes does not apply to a child, or multiple events, or sometimes an event that a reasonable caregiver would need to be seeking medical attention. If this caregiver is the parent guardian of the child, sometimes that is left that slide. So right now, the definition of physical injury is an act performed under circumstances that create a substantial risk of death, or be a serious protracted disfigurement. Oftentimes, the abuse that happens to children do not rise to this standard. So what we're proposing is that there be a new definition of serious physical injury to a child added to the statute that would make it a little more applicable to the cases that we see, and there'll be some pictures here that we might want to have a little warning on about what these things are.
And I do want to caution you. And these photos are not in your copy of the presentation, But I wanted to let you know that we are going to show you some pictures of children who have injuries. And the reason that we show them to you is not for their shock value, but because I think it's important that you understand we're not talking about a parent giving their child a swat on the backside. These are children who are seriously injured by caretakers. And so we want to be sure that you really understand why we're here before you. And these cases are just a representation of many, many cases that are brought to our attention that demonstrate this gap in the laws that we found. This first case is a three-year-old who was burned repeatedly with a cigarette lighter because she couldn't say her ABCs right. So every time she didn't say her ABCs the correct way, her caretaker burned her again. And because this did not meet our current definition for serious physical injury, and because it occurred over the course of one day, and a three-year-old is not somebody who can give a good forensic interview about things that happen multiple times because they don't understand that concept, this was felt to only rise to the level of a misdemeanor, and the perpetrator received 17 days in jail. Whereas it was our opinion that this more truly represented torture of a child. Another example, this was a five-year-old who was strangled by a caregiver. And this five-year-old who had bruising to her neck and petechiae, the ruptured blood vessels in her face, was not able to describe in the right kind of words, because she's only five, to explain what happened to her that would meet our current strangulation assault laws, or definitely not to meet our current physical assault laws where this would rise to a felony
level.
We
should stop on this point because I'm very interested in this specifically. You, as professionals working in this area, know, but a lot of folks listening may not know just what a violent act strangulation is. You know, sometimes it just looks like a little bruise on a neck, and you don't really appreciate how, in the phrase that the professionals uses, how high on the lethality index strangulation falls. It really means you're trying to snuff someone's life out. It's not like a scratch on the face or a slap on the arm. When you grab someone's neck, you're threatening their very ability to live. And so it's an extremely serious assault, and I just appreciate you bringing this to our attention. We see it in domestic violence very frequently, but it speaks to an escalation of domestic violence way past sort of the kicking, scratching phase. I mean, you're really in danger of your life when someone grabs your neck.
Thank you very much. And then finally, this is, again, we've seen multiple instances of cases like this. This is a five-year-old who was beaten by her caretaker's fists. And there's bruising on this child's abdomen, and perhaps it doesn't look that, you know, that bad. But you have to understand that a bruise happens because soft tissue gets caught between two hard surfaces. So for bruising to occur on the abdominal wall, which is very stretchy, purposefully, we're built that way, the abdominal wall has to get trapped between whatever is striking it and the back of the abdominal wall. So the children who end up with injuries like this need extensive blood work. They need to be CAT scanned from head to toe because the risk of intra-abdominal injury, rupturing their liver, rupturing their pancreas, rupturing their intestines, is so high. And we've seen a number of these children that have been beaten with hands or objects that end up being anemic. They have that much blood loss into their soft tissue and their muscles as a result of being hit over and over again. So, and again, these don't meet our current definitions, and they end up being at most considered misdemeanor assaults.
Our solution then is to give a new definition of serious bodily injury to the child, and I'm not going to read it to you all, but you can see it does bring out some examples of that we've seen here that would qualify as serious bodily injury and would qualify for a felony. And this, again, this does give the DA or the prosecutors a more of an option to charge higher if they want to negotiate, and it happens all the time, they do, but at least they can start at a higher level and hopefully maybe can get the prosecution that they need.
And let me just jump in and ask whether you've run this language by the Department of Law. Have you gotten...
We have.
Okay.
We have. In fact, we met with the Deputy Attorney General yesterday. Actually, we've been meeting with them over the past year, running it back and forth, and they would come back with some requests that we change certain things. We would do that.
It's a dialogue. Yeah.
It's a dialogue back and forth. So, yes, we have.
Okay. Well, and I'll look forward to hearing from them, whether it's in a private conversation in my office or in a hearing, just what suggestions or what reactions they had to these proposals. Thank you.
This applies to children under 12. I think the old statute applies dealt with under 10, but now it's under 12 to raise the bar there again, and to children who are under age 16 who are mentally or physically impaired. These new theories basically would be added to all the three assault statutes. So that would, we hope that would solve some of the problems that we see here. We do have some post conviction recommendations too, which would recognize the mental harm also that results from physical injury and creating an aggravator for sentencing if there was seriously bodily injury caused to a child as a result, and result maybe in mental injury too. So our second recommendation is then also to strengthen statutes regarding exposure of children to drugs.
One of the problems that we've seen is that it's been a real challenge for our prosecutors to take forward cases where a child has been exposed to drugs in a way that they test positive for that drug. So we've seen infants testing positive for cocaine because their parents are smoking crack cocaine in front of them, or children nearly dying. These are young children, a little 10-month-old toddler who manages to, get a hold of the drugs that their parent has left sitting out on the coffee table, and the child's almost died as a result of that.
And let me just ask, these are shocking cases. Are there more than a handful? And I'm not asking you to put a number on it, but it's not just an anecdotal once a year kind of a case. These happen with regularity.
Yes, and that's the reason that we're here. If these had been, just one case that had ever happened, then we wouldn't be having this conversation. But we've just had, I work with two of the child advocacy centers in South Central Alaska, and I work with healthcare providers all over the state, and so we discuss these cases on a regular basis. So it's not even a local problem. This is a statewide issue that's come up.
And if I may, this is Jan Rutherdale. I could add that in child abuse and neglect cases, often the children are getting tested for hair follicle analysis and picking up exposure to meth, exposure to cocaine, those kind of things. And when the social worker, talks to the parents about that, they're surprised. Like, well, no, we keep our drugs locked in a safe, or we would never do that around our children. But if you're doing it at home, there could be residue, the kids crawling around, putting things in their mouth. And we're not saying that, all cases have to be prosecuted, but it gives those kind of tools. I do see it in my own practice, from the other side, not the criminal side, but the child abuse and neglect side.
Thank you.
And also, I think we can agree that a meth lab is not a safe place for a child to be. and these meth labs are, of course, not industrial sites. They're done in people's kitchens. They're done in people's homes where there are kids running around. But right now, it's not possible to prosecute them for the harm done to the child. Our solution is to amend the endangering of the welfare of a minor statute by creating two new subsections to penalize the reckless exposure to controlled substances. And these penalties then would vary depending upon the dangerousness of the drug involved.
Another problem has been that ability, as Tom said, to prosecute for indirect exposure to dangerous chemicals used in drug labs, methamphetamine labs.
And again, the solution is to penalize the reckless exposure of the child to the chemicals used in the meth labs. That leads to our third recommendation, was to increase penalties when a parent intentionally withholds adequate food or liquids.
We've again seen now, unfortunately, a number of cases of children who've been starved. And again, we're not talking about, you know, children going to bed without dinner or without their dessert. These are kids that are intentionally starved. Their food's being withheld either as a way of punishing the child or as a way of controlling the child. And we've had children that have had to be hospitalized and, you know, have nearly died as a result of that. And it has been a real challenge, again, for our prosecutors to be able to find criminal language that really has a penalty that is appropriate for the severity of the crime that's been committed against this child.
Again, you saw this picture of a 13-year-old boy. It's hard to imagine that that amount of deprivation of food and liquids. So our solution is to modify the criminal non-support statute to create a Class C felony for a parent or guardian who intentionally fails to provide adequate food or clothing. And the standard for determination of what that would be what a reasonable person would conclude was not, whether or not adequate food or liquids were given to that child.
And this is another area where I'll be turning probably to the Department of Law to give me some idea of what the scope of the problem is. You know, I mean, are they seeing 10 of these cases a year, 50, 5? You know, it's just hard to, if you don't live in that milieu, we just don't know. And so it comes as a shock that this happens, and you just need to have some idea of the scale of the problem. Thank you.
And our fourth recommendation is to create a criminal law that prohibits an incarcerated person from contacting a victim or witness. Now, you know, you would think that, okay, a person's in jail, you know, they should not be able to be contacting the victim or witness. But, you know, there, most more often than not, that occurs after the person has been convicted or after the person has been sentenced. You know, right now, if the person's allowed one phone call, and especially when we're dealing with areas of sexual abuse, by Uncle So-and-so, who will be able to, talk to the person, see how much they love them, how much they care for them, that there was a big mistake, and oftentimes that results in inability to get a conviction because the person, the victim, recants, changes their mind, they don't want to cause the problems, or they're being told that the family is being disrupted, therefore there is no conviction. So this additional statute would prevent them from contacting when they're incarcerated. Because if they're out on bail, of course, there are bail conditions that prevent them from doing so. But right now, there is nothing that, if they're pre-indictment, pre-charging, they're in jail, they can make these phone calls. And oftentimes, it results in no indictment or no charge because of recantation. So the solution, again, is to add two new theories. One, to penalize a person who does make that contact in violation of a no-contact order, and persons who help or assist that person in making contact. Someone who will pass on the message from Uncle So-and-so or from Daddy. We feel that this is also would aid them in doing that.
I appreciate you bringing that to our attention as well. I've worked in this area. I would have said we had a good, strong law in the books with respect to that. But as I'm reviewing the statute here, I've got some question in my mind about what, what conditions pertain to a person who has not been released. It's certainly clear that once you're released, you're under conditions. But and I think I've seen cases of no contact orders violated from jail. I know I've seen them. I just can't remember what statute they were.
That's usually in DV statutes, in domestic violence stuff. They're put in jail. There is a no contact order, but yeah. Mm-hmm.
And of course, in a criminal case, the judge can always order, or a civil case for that matter, order no contact with the victim. But the remedy often is just contempt of court, and that's not often exercised, and it's kind of hard to threaten throwing a person in jail when they're already in jail. But also, more importantly, it's not just to penalize, but to discourage the behavior in the first place, because you could, as Tom mentioned, you could actually prevent the sexual abuse prosecution if the contact is resulting in a recantation of the charges.
Absolutely, and again, we will make sure, I will make sure, personally make sure that we have a good, long discussion with the Department of Law to get their analysis. You know, if there's something missing, we will fix it.
Well, the problem.
So the problem is we've identified that we need some legislative changes that will enhance the safety of our Alaskan children.
And our solution, again, is to introduce and pass proposed legislation, which will make people more accountable. What we're looking for is champion for children.
Great. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, I'm looking at this document. It's got the bill in it. Mm-hmm. So... criminal non-support in the second degree.
What section?
751.120.
Okay.
All right. So, as used in this section, subparagraph B, support includes food, care, clothing, shelter, medical attention, and then, to my great surprise, it has education. What are you guys thinking about?
Just if you know, that's the existing statute. So we're just proposing to separate it into first degree and second degree.
Okay.
So it's not something that we're proposing. It's on the books.
the highlighted
no
portions.
No comment.
The highlighted portions are the portions that we
forgive my not noticing that. Thank you.
Further questions from the committee?
Mr. Chairman. One of the things that in working with the child need of aid laws, which is in the civil law section, and then trying to go over to the criminal law section and find out how some of the enforcement happens, especially, you know, the criminal law section says if the child is in need, you have the right to get that child out of harm's way, and then there's a process for accountability. And I'd be interested in this task force view on how that process interacts with the kind of the criminal process. So once you've got a child in a civil setting, what happens with both the child and the parent if there's a criminal charge, or does it create barriers for criminal charges? It's been something I've kind of watched over the years, and I honestly have had a hard time getting my hands around where do they work well together, or where do they not work well together?
Well, as Senator French, Senator Coghill, I, if I understand your question right, I mean, I often, in my practice, there'll be cases going simultaneously. So there may be a child protection case, child need of aid case involving the child and the child's siblings who have been harmed, and then there is a criminal prosecution going on, and it's just and it stopped me if I didn't understand your question right, but it's oftentimes the child need of aid case will follow the criminal case, because if the person is convicted beyond a reasonable doubt, then we get a bye, you know, we have our case proved. If the DAs decide, well, if they're not convicted beyond a reasonable doubt, we can still go forward because we have preponderance of the evidence as the standard, which is lower. Or if there was a it was resolved in some other way, you know, we can still go forward. I noticed it provides some extra tools. Oftentimes we have parents who are on probation, so they have a felony probation officer, and it's very helpful because the social worker and the probation officer work in tandem, and it may be on the case plan, follow the conditions of probation, and on the probation plan, you know, tell me what's happening with your children's case, you know, that sort of thing, and then they can communicate. So it's kind of an extra tool in that situation.
Mr. Chairman, that's one of the things I probably did miss, is how a probation officer, there's two things I'd like to comment on. First of all, what you do in the Children's Advocacy Center is absolutely the best we can do, and any way we can support those, and I think that also helps us with criminal investigations under those very, very tough circumstances. So I guess before we get into Children's Advocacy Center, where there might be a question on criminal behavior, but not an indictment even, then we have a process that a social worker go through who always has this kind of criminal element around them, and they start a conversation with the parents that may actually thwart any good investigation. So I was just kind of curious how that worked. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, you can actually have a very aggressive caseworker who might want to suppose criminal behavior and put those stipulations on a family that may actually thwart an investigation. Mm-hmm. So I was just wondering how those things dovetail. And we don't have to answer the question now, but because ours is a very prescriptive deal under Title 47, and it's almost the other way in Title 11, where it's you have to go find the information.
Sure.
So it's just very, very different. And I was just kind of wondering how those work. But the PO and the caseworker working together, that was a thanks for the aha on that.
And through the chair,
Ms. Rutherdale, go ahead.
One comment I can make is that we work closely with if there's a current investigation. We may approach a case differently because we don't want to compromise the investigation. Let's say there's a temporary custody hearing and they haven't actually indicted the person yet, and so we may be calling witnesses. It doesn't involve us requiring to. We wouldn't call the officer, for example, because it might compromise the investigation, but we have other information. And conversely, there are times when, I had a OCS worker who the parent was afraid of meeting the social worker because she said, I have a warrant out, you're going to turn me in. And it's like, no, I don't care about that. That's not my business. I need you to work on your case plan. I need to meet with you. And so she arranged, a meeting place that was comfortable. And on the other end of the spectrum, I've had social workers call and say, they're dealing drugs at that home. And I'm like, you know what? Not the best parenting, perhaps, but unless you can show the link between the care of the children and the drug dealing, it's really not our problem. That's not your role. You're not an arm of the police.
Through the chair, answered your question. You made a very good point about the CACs being so important because they do it correctly. If every investigation that came down went through CACs, we wouldn't be having these problems. And what we need is more CACs around the state. But because you don't have multiple interviews. You have police officer there, you have social worker there, you have medical personnel there, and you have it done correctly. So if you're correct, they do well, and if it was done that way all the time, we would not be having half the problems we have about missing the convictions and stuff we did. Thank you.
Good observations. Further comments from the committee? I don't see any. I'll just say that you have assembled here half of the state Senate. And 10 state senators here.
Wow.
Speaks to the interest we have and the desire that we all wanted to sort of get your information directly from you. So Ms. Rutherdale, Mr. Janidlo, Dr. Baldwin Johnson, thank you all for being here. We greatly appreciate it. If there's nothing else to come before the committee, we'll go ahead and say an adjournment.
And I'll just leave these items for you.